Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
WILL programs are made possible by the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, presenting A Midsummer Night's Dream, Richard III, The Tempest, and Scapin from June 25th through August 8th at the Ewing Manor in Bloomington. More information online at thefestival.org or 309-438-8110. Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2. We're streaming online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us today. This afternoon, we're going to talk about decisions. How do we make them? We'll take a look at how we make choices and ask, how could we be better decision makers? Our guest this afternoon is Jonah Lehrer. He is the author of How We Decide. Lehrer describes the book like this. It is about how the human mind, the most complicated object in the known universe, chooses what to do. It's about airline pilots, NFL quarterbacks, television directors, poker players, professional investors, and serial killers, and the decisions they make every day. In addition to How We Decide, Jonah Lehrer is also the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. A contributing editor at Wired, he's written for several other publications, including The New Yorker. He's a contributor to the public radio program Radiolab, and he writes the blog The Frontal Cortex. How We Decide is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Jonah Lehrer, good afternoon. Thanks so much for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. One of the things you say very early in the book is that if it weren't for our emotions, reason wouldn't exist at all. So then why do we tend to disparage the emotional brain?
I think it's a philosophical mistake. I think this goes all the way back to Plato and the ancient Greeks. Plato had this nifty metaphor for decision making. He thought of the mind as a chariot. And there was this rational rider, the rational charioteer, and the job of the rational charioteer was to keep as tight a rein as possible on the emotional horses, these wild animals that will lead you astray. So reason was good, it was prudent, it was deliberate, and our emotions were these kind of wild and tempered beasts that led us to do the wrong thing. So you know, this model, this metaphor, which was used, you know, by Freud, it really was a very, very influential view of decision-making, I think shaped the way we saw emotions and reason and their uses for millennium. And I think that was one of the reasons we've, for so long, disparaged the emotional brain and our emotions. We've seen as, you know, we've seen our feelings as impulsive, impetuous. These things were best, you know, our best bet is to ignore them. When in many instances, you know, we really should trust our feelings. We really should trust these emotional instincts because sometimes we know more than we even know.
Yeah. You like the metaphor provided by Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Herbert Simon. He compares the brain to a pair of scissors. Why is that metaphor useful?
Well, I use that metaphor to justify my approach in the book, which isn't just to simply talk about, you know, some new experiment or some brain scans or whatever, but to try to situate these experiments in the real world, in their context. Because as Herbert Simon pointed out with the scissors, that the mind is like a scissors in the sense that it needs two blades. But for the mind, one blade is the actual brain, you know, what's going on inside our head. And the other blade is the context, the situation in which we're making a decision. And in order to understand how the mind works, you have to look at both blades simultaneously. You know, a scissors with only one blade won't cut anything. So I use that metaphor to explain why I'm not simply describing the science, but why I'm also talking about NFL quarterbacks and airline pilots and serial killers and all the rest, because I think it's very important to if you want to understand how the mind makes decisions, you also have to look at the context in which we're making decisions.
Yeah. Here on the ground.
On the ground. I mean, in terms of actual metaphors for the mind, I think one of my favorite metaphors at the moment is that the brain's a bit like a Swiss Army knife. That it's stuffed full of all these different mental tools. You know, you can be rational, you can be emotional, you can be logical, you can trust your fear, all these different ways of thinking. And just like a Swiss Army knife, what makes it so useful is that it's got all these different tools, each of which is well suited to a particular task. The real secret of good decision making, in a sense, is making sure we're using the right mental tool for the right, you know, at the right moment in the right situation.
You begin with a hair-raising anecdote revealing soon you're in a safe place, a place to practice decision-making. Where were you?
I was in a flight simulator in near the Montreal airport. Before I'd been in a flight simulator, I assumed they were kind of like a fancy video game and that, you know, it was just you go up for a couple hours and you come down and you have a good time. What I didn't realize is how unbelievably stressful flight simulators are. I walked out of that thing. I was exhausted, drenched in sweat and adrenaline. I was just a, you know, shivering mess. And it's because they're so realistic. I mean, the flight simulator I was in, the CAE Tropos 3000, is like $16 million. And it's just, I mean, not only are you staring at, you know, real 3D photographs, but it shakes, it shimmies, it makes all the right noises. So it's an incredibly accurate simulation of what it's like to be a pilot. And what you do in those simulators is practice hair-raising scenarios for the most part. So you practice, you know, losing all engine power over a bustling city, or in the instance I described in the book, my left engine caught on fire as I was making a landing into Tokyo International Airport. And so, part of what pilots learn in such situations is, of course, the checklist of actions, you know, what to do if your engine catches on fire. But I think we also learned something even more important. This is what I'm talking about in the book. And I think we just saw this in the case of Captain Sullenberger and his heroic landing on the Hudson. Mm-hmm. They also learn how to think through their fear. Pilots call this deliberate calm because it takes a deliberate effort to stay calm when stuff goes wrong and to kind of make sure your fear doesn't lead you astray and just ripen into panic. So, that's what fascinated me about pilots, and that's why I think in many respects pilots are such model decision makers, because they not only practice kind of the sheer routine they have to go through in various circumstances, but they also practice how to think. They practice how to make decisions in various circumstances, how to trust their feelings, and also how to not trust their feelings, how to think through their feelings when their feelings aren't being helpful.
Yeah, and in that setting, in that simulator, they can make mistakes, and that's something that is also good.
Absolutely. It's not only that they make mistakes, because of course they make mistakes, it's how those mistakes are treated. After you go through a flight simulator, you then go through a debriefing where your instructor takes you through and scrutinizes every little decision you made and asks you questions. It forces you to kind of focus and pay attention to all those mistakes you made, mistakes that maybe didn't have big consequences and yet were still mistakes. And you know, I think there's evidence from a bunch of different levels of analysis. You can look at our brain cells, how our brain cells learn, to studies of second graders in New York City. And what you find is that the most effective way to learn, and I cover this in the book by looking at various experts, from a soap opera director to a backgammon to one of the best backgammon players in the world. And what you find is that the best experts, they all learn by studying their mistakes. They have this fixation on looking at their mistakes, on looking on their errors, and that turns out to be an incredibly efficient and effective way to get better.
And they really want to be tested in very trying drills.
Yes. Yes, they want to push themselves to the limit and take the harder tests, play the harder teams, play the harder opponents, simulate the hardest scenarios in the flight simulator, because they know, you know, it's when you're at your limit that you're most likely to make mistakes, and when you're making mistakes, that's when you're learning something new. I've got a great quote from Niels Bohr. It says, an expert is simply one who has made all the possible mistakes in a field, because there is no way to learn without mistakes. I think too often we try to minimize our mistakes. We refuse to admit error, when from the perspective of your brain, that's simply how you learn. It's very difficult to learn unless you're making mistakes too.
Practice, practice, practice.
Yes. Well, that's really what practice is, yeah. Is effective practice is deliberate practice. And deliberate practice means you're really pushing yourself. And by pushing yourself, it means you really make mistakes.
You mentioned Captain Sullenberger in U.S. Airways Flight 1549. And the captain in the crews of airplanes practice deliberate calm. However, passengers do not. And in this situation, the passengers on board that flight seemed to be remarkably calm to me. What can you tell us about keeping fear from becoming panic? And what is there such a thing as collective calm? We know what a mob can do.
Yeah.
What about collective calm?
I mean, that's a fascinating idea. I think in general, all our emotions are pretty contagious. That's just a general truism of social interactions, that yawns are contagious, smiles are contagious, fear is contagious, rage is contagious, that our emotions spread from one person to the next with surprising ease. I think one way to look at what happened on Sullenberger's, on the U.S. Airways flight, is simply that very few people on board knew just how bad things were. I think people, obviously on board knew something had gone awry, knew they weren't following the flight plan. But until the very last minute, I mean, a few interviews I saw, the passengers said they didn't know they were actually going to land on the water until Captain Sullenberger came on the radio about 5 seconds before they landed and said, assume the crouch position. Captain Sullenberger himself, who of course was one of the few people on board who knew how bad things were, he talked about how scared he was. He talked about, you know, as he put it, turmoil on the inside, calm on the outside. And that's as good a definition as you'll ever get of deliberate calm. I do think it was his ability to kind of think through his fear that allowed him to make the right decision, to realize he won't be able to make it to Teterboro, New Jersey. Scientists 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was the assumption that what allowed some people to be heroic in stressful circumstances, what allowed some people to be like Captain Sullenberger, was that these people simply experienced less fear in the first place, that their amygdala, a brain area that pumps out these scary, anxious emotions, would be less active than other people. And that's what allowed them to be braver and more heroic. It turns out that's not really true, that everyone's amygdala turns on. It's a very primal, automatic brain area. We don't have very much control over it. So everyone gets scared. Everyone shows the bodily symptoms of fear. Everyone gets adrenaline pumped into their bloodstream. That's just the way we're built. The crucial variable, it turns out, is how active a brain area called the prefrontal cortex is. This is the brain area involved with rational, deliberative thought. And it turns out that some people's prefrontal cortex turns on much more in response to fear, in response to certain situations. And that's something that you can really improve with practice and training. In fact, that's probably the most important variable. And I think that's what explains Captain Sullenberger. It wasn't something that he wasn't scared, because, as he'll be the first one to admit, he was terrified. It's that even though he was scared, he was still able to think straight.
Yeah. Well, if you weren't scared, you know, something's wrong.
Yes. No.
Right?
Yeah. You know. And I think there was this assumption for so long, going back to Plato, that maybe the best decision makers, the most perfect decision makers, would be purely rational. That somehow not having any emotions at all would make you a better chooser, better decider, better person. But it turns out not being able to experience emotions, not getting scared in such situations, is actually a terrible disease. It's debilitating. I talk about the work of Antonio Damasio, a neurologist who's now at USC, who has studied for many years patients who, because of a brain tumor in their frontal lobes, have lost the ability to experience emotion. And what you find is that these people become pathologically indecisive, that they'll spend all day trying to figure out, you know, where to eat lunch. So imagine them, someone purely rational, trying to make a decision about where to land, you know, as you're losing engine power over New York City. They're the last person you'd want as your pilot. So you know, I think this goes back to this mistaken assumption we had about the pros and cons of reason and emotion, that you need emotion in your system or else you just won't be able to make any decision at all.
So Mr. Spock is an impossibility.
Well, Mr. Spock or variations of Mr. Spock exist. It's just Mr. Spock isn't something to aspire to. That being like Spock, being purely rational, that's not a goal. That's actually a disease.
Hmm. But he's such a fine officer.
Well, maybe the new Star Trek movie will be a little bit more neurologically accurate.
Well, who knows? I don't know. I don't know who's the doctor in the new movie, but maybe Bones, who was the guy on the TV show who was always so emotional.
Yeah.
Maybe he's the model.
I don't know enough about Star Trek, but you know, I mean,
you're a little younger than I am, I think.
Spock is clearly a great character. You know, it's amazing when you talk about reason and emotion how quickly Spock comes up. So he's clearly this cultural totem, and I think it's slightly unfortunate in the sense that it's I think shaped the way a lot of people see reason and emotion. Just because to be like Spock isn't something good at all. And you know, the few episodes of Star Trek I've watched, you know, you get that sense too that you probably wouldn't want to be Spock, or maybe even, you know, that you do sense some deficits in Spock, but they don't make clear just how debilitating being like Spock would actually be.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Jonah Lehrer. His latest book is How We Decide. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with the telephone call 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Your questions and comments are invited. Let's take a call now from a listener in Tazewell County on line one. Hi.
Hi there. This is very interesting. I have found a way that I cope with fear. I've been in a few, fortunately only a few, life-threatening situations. And what I discovered is if I ask myself what is the worst that can happen, even if that answer is I could die, once I've asked that question and answered it, then it frees me up to go ahead and do what I need to do to perhaps save the situation. I don't know what's going on in my brain to allow that to happen, but I find it very effective.
That sounds like a great technique, and I think what you're doing there is introducing just a modicum of thought to, you know, to this very emotional moment, and that allows you to think. I mean, I think the key lesson is that everyone comes up with their own strategies. I mean, I talk to some pilots who chew big wads of gum, and they find that somehow relieves the stress and lets them kind of deal with fear. Some pray, some say a quick prayer. So everyone's got their own strategies. Everyone's got their own kind of coping mechanisms that help them think through fear. And that sounds like a great one. I'm even more impressed that even when the worst case scenario is death, you still don't panic, because I'm afraid that might make it even worse for me. Mm. But, you know, if it works for you, I mean, amen. So much of this is about self-experimentation and finding the keys that unlock your locks that help you deal with these very difficult situations.
Yeah, and that unlocks the paralysis that I fear in that kind of a situation. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
You.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. We recently had the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin, and he is sort of, I guess, considered to be a very rational, in many ways, an emotional. You may have heard that when he was deciding whether he should get married or not. He sort of made a list of marry and don't marry. And he put down all of the consequences of those decisions, and he concluded that he should get married. That seemed very reasonable and unemotional. I'd like to get some comment about that approach.
Sure. That's one of my favorite Darwin stories. Darwin, to his credit, then realized that pro and con checklist to evaluate whether or not he should marry Emma wasn't that helpful. So then he ended up, you know, trusting the thing he had to trust in the first place, which is his emotions. You know, you're trying to choose love. You're not trying to pick a car. clearly Darwin was trying to be rational. I think at the same time he also discovered the limits, in a sense, of reason. I mean, just in general, in terms of the utility of making pros and cons less, I think one difficulty with this is that it's often very tough to actually know what are the important reasons to us. I talk about some work in the book done by Timothy Wilson, who's a psychologist at the University of Virginia. He did a classic experiment involving strawberry jam. So in the mid-'80s, Consumer Reports did this exhaustive survey of strawberry jam and ranked all the best jams from best to worst. And then Professor Wilson was interested in whether or not undergraduates would also share these preferences with the expert jam tasters at Consumer Reports. And what he found was that if you just give students basically a jam to try, that they're pretty good, that we're all expert jam tasters, that they also found the best-tasting jams and the worst-tasting jams, according to Consumer Reports, were jams these students also didn't like. But then he found that there was one very simple way to disrupt this whole process, that if you simply ask students to explain why they chose one jam over another, all of a sudden now some of the worst-tasting jams were ranked highest and some of the best-tasting jams were ranked low. And the reason, according to Wilson, is that when we start searching for explicit reasons, when we start trying to explain why we don't like or actually prefer a jam, that all of a sudden then we get into this very misleading thought process. So we'll say, you know, this jam has a chunky texture. And so we'll say, you know, we'll think to ourselves, you know, a chunky texture is a good reason to not like a jam. But maybe we like chunky texture jams, or maybe we don't even care about texture. In other words, the reasons we come up with, even though they may sound good, may actually be irrelevant. And in terms of, I think, making these checklists, coming up with long lists of pros and cons, I think one danger in trying to force very complex decisions into this rubric is that we end up coming up with reasons which may or may not be relevant, but they sound good. And so they become motivational and influential factors in our decision when maybe they shouldn't be factors at all.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, that's very interesting. Thank you for your answer.
Thanks for the call. Is that what happened to Coca-Cola when they introduced New Coke?
That was a bad decision on many levels. But I think, certainly I think there are many examples of decisions we make where we come up with reasons. I mean, another example is research at the University of the Netherlands, an experiment where they asked people to choose between two homes. One home was a two-bedroom apartment in the center of the city with a very short commute. The other home was a three-bedroom house. So an extra bedroom was a little bit bigger, but at a 45-minute commute. And what they found is that the more time people spend thinking about this decision, about which home they should choose, the more likely they were to choose the home out in the suburbs. And the reason was because that extra bedroom, having that third bedroom, became more and more important. They would start to think about, oh, you know, when Grandpa Joe visits at Christmas, he can stay in that extra bedroom. Mm-hmm. My brother comes in the summer, he can stay there. And so even though they may only use this bedroom 3, 4, 5 times a year, it began to seem essential. Meanwhile, they were undervaluing the importance of a long commute. Lots of studies show that just about the worst thing you can do for your happiness is have a long commute. That it makes you very miserable, that sitting in traffic, there's nothing worse than that if you kind of ask people how they're feeling during the day. So they were undervaluing this thing, this factor, this variable, which was very important, and overvaluing this thing, which turned out, you know, to maybe not be that relevant. Just put Grandpa Joe up in a hotel for 2 days.
Right.
You don't need an extra bedroom. So that's another example of how thinking too much and trying to come up with reasons can actually lead you astray.
Yeah. My guess is that those folks were first-time home buyers, because if you've had a home, you know an empty room fills up awfully quickly. With stuff you don't need.
Yes. Well, that's a whole other reason the scientists didn't even consider. That's a good point.
Let's take another call, a listener in Chicago. Line 4, hi.
Thank you. Among the decisions a person has to make, dealing with a lot of mistakes, and there's a point of maybe giving up. And we have an example of Edison, who, in attempting to develop the light bulb, was asked, how often have you tried to develop the bulb? He said, about 500-600 times. He said, doesn't that discourage you to the point of giving up? And he said, no, it's just another mistake I don't have to make. And then you go on to another broader, more in-depth decision-making was part of President Truman in agreeing to allow the atomic bomb to be dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to the point where having consulted with all those so-called advisors, that it's the wisest thing to do, given the context, as you point out, being so important, that he went to sleep after having made the decision. He said he slept like a baby. And then, of course, you have the other example of those who've unfortunately been, where those thoughts and brains got them to regard other people as less than human, like in the Holocaust, perpetrators who were told to go ahead and without any qualms in making the decision to exterminate all the people that they have. And examples like this come into mind. So your decision-making choices are so important. We hope that our future leaders in that can make the right decisions as opposed to the bad ones that we've seen in the past with their decision-making and reasoning. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. John O'Leary, you have a chapter on moral decision-making. You want to jump in there?
Yeah. You know, I think for a long time, people saw each other as kind of these Hobbesian brutes, as we were just these nasty Darwinian creatures who were just out for ourselves. And while certainly people can do all sorts of evil stuff to each other, you know, as your caller said, a lot of that stuff happens when we stop thinking about other people as humans, when we dehumanize them, when the Nazis considered Jews to be subhuman, or in Rwanda, when people considered other people like cockroaches, as they put it. You know, then we can do evil things to each other. But in general, in everyday life, what you find when you look at the brain, when you look at morality and moral decision-making from the perspective of the brain, is that humans are surprisingly moral creatures, that we're possessed with this very profound sense of sympathy and empathy, what Adam Smith called fellow feeling. So, for instance, if you put someone in a brain scanner and show them the face of someone else in pain, their own brain lights up as if they were in pain. In other words, we naturally sympathize with the suffering and hurt and anguish of someone else. And that's a big motivation in terms of why it feels so bad to hurt someone else, why we feel bad when someone else is in pain, and why we often take action so we can avoid hurting someone else. So we come kind of pre-programmed with this powerful set of moral instincts, and this is really just a byproduct of the fact that we're social primates and we had to learn how to live in a group. And so a big part of living in a group is not killing each other. And you see this in other primates and other monkeys, and I think it's a very powerful force when it comes to human decision-making and human morality, is the fact that it hurts to hurt someone else, and so that's why we're, you know, often, to the surprise of all sorts of people, very moral creatures.
Yeah. And when it doesn't hurt to hurt, then you have a psychopath.
Exactly. And so there's been lots of research in the last couple of years on what causes psychopathy or sociopaths. And the crucial missing thing in their brain is this innate sympathy, is this powerful set of moral emotions which keep them from doing wrong. So they don't get that same negative feeling, that negative rush when they hurt someone else. And so that makes them much more likely to use violence to achieve a goal, which is a crucial definition of what makes a psychopath.
Yeah. A broken amygdala, you say.
That's one of the, I think, leading hypotheses at the moment, that the amygdala is this brain area which generates all these negative emotions we talked about in the context of fear earlier, but it also pumps out other negative feelings too. One hypothesis is that psychopaths show reduced activity in their amygdala, so they don't get as scared or anxious or experience all those negative emotions that the rest of us feel when we hurt someone else or even just see a random stranger crying on the street. And so there have been a bunch of studies done where you simply show people signs of violence, you know, a handgun or a big cut, or just someone, you know, shrieking. And what you see in the, you know, when you put psychopaths in scanners, that they don't show the same level of automatic activity and response.
Mm. Now, we also know, though, that emotions can get the best of us. How can they lead us? How do they lead us to make bad decisions?
Well, I think we're living through the consequences of that right now. I'm thinking about subprime mortgages. Why did people take out subprime mortgages? That's a classic example of impulsivity. And when you talk about impulsivity, you are talking about our emotional brain leading us astray. Our emotions are great at all sorts of stuff, but they're pretty bad when it comes to thinking about the future. And so they'll take the, you know, when it comes to a 2.28 mortgage, they'll take the low interest rate for the first 2 years and not think about, you know, can I really afford this house? What happens when the, you know, when the interest rate adjusts? Stuff like that. That's a no concern to your emotional brain. It just wants to move into the big new house with this nice low teaser rate. So, I mean, that's a classic example of how, you know, your emotional brain can lead you astray, can lead you to be too impulsive and take out loans you can't afford. I think credit cards, you know, another classic example of the emotional brain. There's some interesting work done by George Lowenstein at Carnegie Mellon and Brian Knutson at Stanford University, where they studied what happens in your brain when people make shopping decisions. And what they found is that there's really an emotional tug of war that takes place when you choose whether or not to buy something. They did this experiment with undergraduates, and they gave them all sorts of options. They could choose whether or not to buy, like, a George Foreman grill or the new Harry Potter book, stuff like that. What they found was that when you show people something they want, so let's say you really want that new George Foreman grill, a brain area called the nucleus accumbens lights up. This is a brain area associated with feelings of pleasure and desire. It's what, you know, it's the brain area that gets active when your team wins the World Series. Whenever you feel good, nucleus accumbens is probably active. So you see this item, the brain area turns on, and you get this intense pleasure that makes you want to buy the George Foreman grill. At the same time, when you show people the price tag of the item, how much the George Foreman grill costs, you see activation in a brain area called the insula. This is an area that's often associated with things like bodily pain, feelings of disgust, and it turns out having to pay for something. So there's this tug of war taking place. One brain area says, buy the George Foreman grill. The other brain area says, don't, it costs too much money. And the scientists could actually make pretty accurate predictions of what people would do based on the relative activation of these two brain areas. Yeah. Now, here's where credit cards come into play. Turns out when people pay with credit cards, the insula is less active than normal because credit cards abstract the transaction because, you know, you're not taking cash out of your wallet. You know, it's not a physical thing. You're just swiping a plastic card, and then the purchase will show up on your bill in 30 days. Because they abstract the transaction, your insula doesn't quite understand what's happening. And so it's not as sensitive to the pain of actually paying for stuff. And so the end result, of course, is that people spend too much money because this tug of war is kind of thrown out of whack because the pleasure dictates the search for pleasure, this emotional search for pleasure dictates every decision. You end up buying things you can't afford and racking up lots of credit card debt. And as we're now seeing, that has consequences too. So I think we can view a lot of the problems we're trying to work through right now, be it, you know, the mortgage crisis, these various bubbles in cheap credit and, you know, real estate, as evidence of just how bad it is to let your emotional brain, you know, run reckless and run wild.
Yeah. It's also really interesting, though, to think about how we are wired to be risk averse and how that doesn't kick in when we can't get a grip on what it's going to cost us down the line.
Yeah, well, people do have this natural aversion to risk and especially loss. But the thing is, this is all about the present tense. And so your emotions just aren't very good about thinking about loss in the future. So there is this distinction between, you know, what's happening right now. I want this George Foreman girl right now that'll make me happy. And what your emotions aren't thinking about is in 30 days, this will show up on a credit card bill and I won't be able to afford it. That's of no concern to them. This is when you have to exert reason and force yourself to think about this. Instead of just trusting these feelings, saying, buy the George Foreman grill, you should really be focusing on, gosh, what else have I bought this month? What else is going to be in my bill? Can I afford this? Questions like that, rational, deliberate questions that probably involve some numbers. Your emotional brain doesn't like numbers very much. It just wants, you know, pleasure versus pain. That's how it evaluates the world. Mm-hmm. But yes, you're absolutely right in the sense that people are strongly averse to losses. We're pretty risk averse in general, too. But, you know, loss aversion is another great example of an emotional bias. So the basic message is our brain, our head is stuffed full of all these kind of quirks and biases and heuristics and things that often lead us astray. And the only way to avoid these mistakes is to know about them, is to read about this long list of mistakes that psychologists have identified over the last 15, 20, 25 years.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Jonah Lehrer, author of How We Decide. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments about decision-making. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Speaking of brains stuffed full of stuff, it was great fun to read about quarterbacks. We want pilots who make good decisions on the job, but it's also high on the list of football teams looking for a good quarterback.
Yeah.
Give us some sense of all the stuff that a quarterback is going through in making an important play.
It's a pretty daunting list. I mean, you think about it, they've got 3 seconds, maybe 4 seconds if they're lucky, if the offensive line holds. And they've basically got to look at the 20 other players in the field. They've got to keep track of the linebackers and the cornerbacks and the safeties. Often now in teams running the spread offense, they'll have to check off 4 or 5 different receivers. You know, they'll really have to search the field. So you're talking 3 seconds. They've got to scan the whole field and figure out, look at these 4 different receivers and figure out who's the best option, find the most open man. And the question is, how do they do that? It seems so daunting. I mean, all this information, all these variables you have to take in and then make a decision very, very quickly before, you know, you're drilled into the ground by a 350-pound offensive lineman, which hurts a lot. And I think when you talk to quarterbacks, what you find is that it's a very emotional thought process, that they often make decisions for reasons they can't quite explain. They'll just say, you know, he just felt like the right guy to go to. They'll use the language of emotion and feeling. And I think the only way to make these kinds of decisions, to take in this much information this quickly, is to rely on your unconscious and to rely on your emotions. In the same way, if you ask a Major League Baseball player, how did you decide to swing at that fastball? They'll say, I don't know. You know, I mean, they can't, the conscious brain can't think that fast. Instead, the baseball player is forced to rely on these subliminal cues, things that happen so fast they have no conscious awareness of it, you know, the torque of the pitcher's wrist, how they're holding the ball, stuff like that. And then they're able to make decisions based on that information. And that's only possible because of just how, number one, how quickly our emotional brain works, and number two, the fact that it can take in much more information than we're actually aware of. So you really do know more than you know.
Is it at all like what happens when we get on a bicycle?
In the sense that once you put in the practice,
yeah,
it becomes automatic.
Yeah.
That's a very similar analogous process in the sense that once you learn how to do it, once you put in the practice, and once you make the mistakes as we talked about, then it seems so easy. Then you're able to do stuff without that explicit thought.
Mm.
And in fact, you actually perform better the less you think about it. There's some interesting work done by research at the University of Chicago where they actually bring in expert golfers into their lab. And what they find is that beginner golfers actually hit better putts when they're thinking about the details of the stroke, when they're thinking about how they're holding the putter, how, you know, how their hips are positioned, how their feet are positioned, stuff like that, because they avoid beginner's mistakes, so they actually hit better putts. However, experts, when you bring in expert golfers into the lab and have them think about the details of their stroke, all of a sudden now their stroke falls apart.
Mm.
All of a sudden now they're basically choking in the lab. They're so fixated on details that they're overriding the fact, you know, this all the years of practice. They're basically playing like amateurs. So once you become an expert, you're able to do things automatically that if you're a beginner are just incomprehensible.
Yeah. It's like dancers who talk about muscle memory.
Exactly. It's unless you put in the practice, it seems impossible. I have no idea how you hit a 95-mile-per-hour fastball. I have no idea how a QB makes those kinds of decisions so quickly. And yet, because they put in the practice, because they've got these years of experience, because they've got the muscle memory, they make it look easy.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking about the amygdala. That's, you said, where sympathy, empathy is centered in the brain. Did I get that right?
It's part of that network. Yes.
Oh, all right. Okay, that may be an oversimplification. Okay, well, how come my husband, who is basically a nice guy, can watch these terrible, horrible murder mysteries on TV, and I look at it for 10 seconds and I'm my heart's beating and I'm basically screaming inside and I walk out of the room.
It's a great question. I'm not sure science has an answer for you yet. I mean, I think some people just have more tolerance for stuff when they know it's pretend, when they know it's just a movie. They're better able at saying, this is just a horror movie. I mean, for instance, I can't watch horror movies at all. I find it so unpleasant. I get so scared. Whereas everyone else in my family has no problem doing it. They say, but it's just a movie. You know nothing. You know it's not real. So I think some people are just better off, are just better at kind of keeping that frame around the experience. And so they always know it's not real, and so they can actually enjoy being a little bit scared. Whereas I just find the whole thing very, very unpleasant.
So you don't know what happens in the different people's brains, different brains about that. All right. Thank you. That was fun.
Sorry.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I suppose that's why some of us are roller coaster people and some of us would rather just to sit on the merry-go-round.
Yeah. I mean that's I think another example of how individual differences, which for the most part remain pretty mysterious for the field, for scientists, but they often drive our behavior a lot. I think they're just beginning to look at how differences in dopamine receptor subtypes, for instance, differences in genes like DRD1 and DRD4, can explain a lot of the variation in terms of how willing people are to tolerate risk, whether or not you like mountain climbing and going on roller coasters, stuff like that. So we're just beginning to understand what explains, very basic behavioral traits like that. But I think we're not quite, no one's found the gene for horror movies yet.
One of the interesting things about dopamine that I learned as a result of reading How We Decide is that dopamine neurons are constantly trained and retrained.
Yes. For a long time, people saw the job of dopamine as kind of the neurotransmitter. It's a neurotransmitter, so it helps brains. So it's what allows brain cells to communicate with each other. That dopamine was seen as kind of the neurotransmitter responsible for sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was the chemical of hedonism. And it certainly is responsible for a lot of that stuff, but it's also, it turns out, even more important. And it really helps people with basic elements of cognition. It allows you to make predictions and make sure your predictions are accurate. It allows you to transform the helter-skelter of reality into neat chains of causation and correlation. And this gets back to how dopamine neurons work. What they're constantly doing is making predictions about what's going to happen, about what event leads to which event leads to which event. And then if those predictions turn out to be wrong, then they recalculate everything and make a whole new set of predictions. So they're always trying to narrow what's called the prediction error signal, trying to make fewer mistakes, which is why focusing on your mistakes can be so helpful to them. You can kind of fast forward this process along. But yes, individual dopamine neurons can be very surprisingly knowledgeable about what's going to happen. And they're a crucial element that allows us to actually understand reality, to predict what's going to happen, and to really get more accurate, make more accurate predictions with experience. That these dopamine neurons, you have to train them. It takes time and trials and practice and effort. But once you put in the effort, they really are a great way to learn.
Very interesting. We're coming down here in the last couple of minutes of the program, and I wanted to talk with you a little bit about swine flu. Right now we're seeing, world, national, and local health authorities trying to get on top of a situation and stay on top and make good decisions. And I don't know, do you have any thoughts to share in terms of how decision-making works in this kind of a situation?
Well, I think there are absolutely conflicting impulses here. On the one hand, I think it's very important not to panic. You don't want to blow what's happening out of perspective. And at the same time, I think it's also the job of these policymakers, these politicians, people at the CDC, to also make people aware that there is a real danger, and so that they don't take unwarranted risks, that they wash their hands, that they be wary of flu symptoms, stuff like that. So I think it's a very fine line we have to walk between, on the one hand, being vigilant and being aware, but not panicking. And that can be a very tough thing, a very fine line to walk, especially, I think, in today's media environment where, the internet is full of, full of very useful information, but also lots of perhaps, scaremongering and people pushing, story angles that might be exaggerating the facts a little bit. So it's a very fine line to walk between making us nervous but not making us too nervous.
Right.
I think the other thing to keep into account, and this gets back to stuff we were talking about and how people process risk, and is that risk is largely an emotional process. This is why people get very scared when they fly on planes, even though flying on a plane is the safest way to travel anywhere. But we get much more scared traveling on the plane than driving to work. If you look at the sheer brute statistics, driving to work is actually the much riskier and more hazardous proposition. And this is because we're not very rational about how we evaluate risk. How we evaluate risk is largely emotional. So I think it's also important to take that into account, realizing that people aren't simply looking at the numbers here and realizing and thinking about, you know, how unlikely it is that they may catch swine flu, that they may fall victim. What they're thinking about is the feelings, how they're feeling, how this seems very scary. And so I think you really have to take that into account, too.
Yeah. So maybe it goes back to our first caller this afternoon, to take a step back and go, wait a minute.
Exactly. You know, too often what we don't do is think enough about thinking, is think about, wait, why am I so scared? Is my fear justified? It just takes a few extra seconds of cognition. Just take a deep breath and think about, why am I so scared right now? Is my fear really justified? Let me think for a second about the numbers. And perhaps that's the best way to calm ourselves down right now.
Practice deliberate calm.
Exactly, just like
okay.
a pilot.
All right. Joan O'Lara, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Joan O'Lara is the author of How We Decide. In addition to How We Decide, he's the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. He's a contributing editor at Wired. He's also a contributor to the public radio program Radiolab, and he writes the blog The Frontal Cortex. How We Decide is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
And you've been listening to an archived interview from the Focus 580 Archives. You can find this and other interviews, if you'd like to take another listen to them, or for the first time if you missed them on the air, at will.illinois.edu. And the time is coming up on 1:52. It's time for the highs, lows, and settlements in the commodity markets and the Mercantile Exchange. And first of all, looking at the numbers from the commodity markets today, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. That's the last. Jay, thanks so much. Let's take a look at those numbers as they finished out this afternoon in Chicago. Like this in the wheat bit, futures were down 9.25 cents. The high at 555.5, the low at 542. Settlement price there at 546, 9.25 lower. The July soft red winter wheat. September futures, 584.5, the high, the low at 71. Settlement price at $5.75, down 9.5 cents. In December, 611.25 for the high, the low at 597.25. Settled at 601.5, 9.25 lower. The March futures 624 for the high, the low at 14.5. Settled at 618.5, down 8.75. And the May contract in the soft red, 8 cents lower. July of next year, down 9 cents. In Kansas City, July nearby, 10.75 lower, with the settlement price at $6.04 on the afternoon. From the corn pit in Chicago, a 14 cent loss today, down at 3.99 on its top, a bottom at 3.80. Settlement price at 385.25, down 14. September futures, 407.75, the high, the low at 388.25. Settlement price at 393.5, down 13.75. And December corn futures, 421, the high, the low at $4. Settlement price at 405.5, down 14 cents. March futures, 432, the high, the low at 12.5. Settlement price at $4.17, down 14. In the May contract, 439, the high, the low at 421. Settled at 425, down 14.5 cents on the afternoon. And the December of next year, down 11.5 cents, 428, the high, the low at 415. Settlement price there at 416.5, down 11.5 cents for the December corn of next year. July oat futures, 212, the high, the low at 197.5. Settlement price at 203.5, down 8.5. September, 213, down 8.5. July soybean futures, 27.5 cents lower, 1184.5, the high, the low at 1150.5. Settlement price, 1151.5, down 27.5 on the afternoon. And the August contract, 1122.5, the high, the low at 1088.75. Settlement price at $10.90. August soybeans down 30 cents for the day. September futures, 1051, the high, low at 1017.25, settled at 1023, down 27.5. And the November beans, 1009.25 for the high, the low at 10 or rather at 970 and three quarters. Settlement price at 981. November beans, 981, down 25 cents. January futures, 1013 for the high, the low at 978 and a quarter. Settled 988 and a half, 24 and a half lower. And the March contract, 1010 the high, the low at 978 and three quarter. Settlement price at $9.85 and a quarter, down 25 and a quarter. The 2010 November contract settled at $9.15 and three quarters, down 27 and three quarters. July soybean meal at $3.92.40, top, bottom at $3.75.70. Settled $3.77, $13 lower. The August down $11.90 at $3.52.30. And the July soybean oil today had a top of $36.75, a bottom at $35.68, settled $35.93, 60 cents lower. August contract $36.91, the high, the low at $35.83, settlement price at $36.07, down 61 cents. This afternoon during the closing mark report, we usually talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's not available today, nor are the folks up at Bates Commodities, but Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. So we'll talk with him during the CMR this afternoon instead of Kurt. And later in the program, of course, the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County will join us to take up the cash grain market. It all comes up at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. That's exactly 10 minutes away. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And a look at the livestock numbers now. Live cattle for June had a high today of 81.50, a low of 81.05. The settlement, 81.47.5, up 55. August live cattle had a high of 82.90, a low of 82.15. The settlement was 82.85, up 72.5. October, the high was 88.55. The low was 87.65. The settlement, 88.52.5, up 77.5. And December had a high of 89.20, a low of 88.50. The settlement was 89.05, up 17.5. August feeder cattle had a high of 99.05 and a low of 98.30. The settlement was 98.92.5, up 82.5. September had a high of 99, low of 98.35. The settlement was 98.87.5, up 62.5. October had a high of 99.10, a low of 98.40. The settlement was 99.05. That was up 65. And the November feeder cattle contract had a high of 99.40, a low of 98.60. The settlement was 99.30, and that was up 70. July lean hogs had a high of 61.50, a low of 60. The settlement was 60.45, down 97.5. August had a high of 61.60, a low of 60.30. The settlement was 60.85, down 95. October, a high of 57.85, a low of 56.50. The settlement, 56.87.5, down 107.5. And December lean hogs had a high of 59.60, a low of 58.30. The settlement was 58.67.5, down 125. Frozen pork bellies for July had a high of 62.50, a low of 60.75. The settlement was 61.90, excuse me. And that was up 175. And August frozen pork bellies had a high of 63.25, a low of 60.90. The settlement was 62.70, and that contract closed up 190. Well, at WILL, our success depends upon the financial support of the people we serve. The power really is in your hands. State and federal budgets are not set. Who knows what support they'll provide? As of right now, we are within $194,000 of having the money that it's going to take to bring you the service that you expect from us in the coming year. That is $7,000 closer than our last report, and counting. Now, as we work to raise the remaining money by June 30th, the end of our fiscal year, we ask that you please do what you can. Call now, 217-244-9455. Or you can log on to willpledge.org, and together we will raise that remaining $194,000.
Dearly beloved.
Later today on All Things Considered,
we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life.
We start a new series, acclaimed musical artists on their favorite music.
I think he sums up everything I think about life when he says, in this life, you're on your own. And if the elevator tries to bring you down, go crazy.
You must hear this on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Well, we have a heat advisory in effect, and it includes Champaign and Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland.